Hello and welcome to the week that really was for the week ending the 22nd of March 2024. And what a week it was. It was a week of high drama. We saw, Sarah, the fall of the House of Varadkar. So I think there's not really much else to talk about this week. So let's kick into it. But we'll talk about him first and then we'll talk about what comes next. So what was your reaction to the news? Where were you when they heard it, as they used to say about John F. Kennedy and Jo?
I was actually at home on the phone to someone. He's also a political nerd, and he got a message on his phone about Fiona and Sheehan had put up that there was an earthquake announcement being made at 12 o'clock. And so he told me, and then we were kind of speculating as to what it might be. And then as it got closer to 12, there was no other thing that it could have been other than this, if you know what I mean. So I was at home. But I think I'm not the only one. I was pretty shocked.
I was not shocked, I have to say. I was not shocked because I saw it coming this year, as I reminded you yesterday in my piece at the beginning of the year where I wrote my predictions for the year. I thought that one of him or Micheál Martin would not survive the year. I thought he'd last a bit longer than this. But I think it's been, I've just never looked at Leo Varadkar and thought, this is a guy who loves the job he's doing. I mean, I look at Micheál Martin, and you know, God knows we had a good go at Micheál Martin on this show last week. But Micheál Martin is a guy who loves power. He loves being the Taoiseach. He loves being the leader of Fianna Fáil. It's his job. It's his social life as well as his professional life. He loves it. And that's not necessarily a recommendation of his character. Leo Varadkar, on the other hand, I mean, I looked at this guy for the last couple of years and I was like, what are you doing? I just fundamentally don't believe that he was enjoying the job. Things were not going well, hadn't been going well for a number of years with Fine Gael. So I wasn't shocked. And I'm not sure. I mean, I know Fionnuala Sheehan broke the story, and massive scoop, credit to Fionnuala Sheehan. He's one of our best journalists and proved it again yesterday by getting that story when no one else had it. But I'm not sure a political earthquake really is a good description, because it's an earthquake only in the sense that if you're in the Leinster House bubble where you're concerned with who's up and who's down and who's getting promoted and who's out and who's moving sideways, then yes, biggest drama in the world. But for the actual ordinary people of the country, I'm not really sure it rises to the level of tremor, to be honest.
Well, I mean, I think you're right and wrong at the same time. I mean, I think that years ago it would have been bigger, but because we've had a rotating Taoiseach, and to quote Padraig O'Beirne, you know, the role is being handed around like snuff out of wake, it's kind of diminished it somewhat. So, you know, we'll now be going on to our third Taoiseach in this government term. So, you know, it's not as big because of that. But I still think the leader of the country coming out and saying he resigns as leader is pretty big.
Yeah, fair. No, I'm not trying to say it's only a minor story and we all paid too much attention to it or anything like that. I'm just saying that for the ordinary person out there sitting at home paying their taxes every week, concerned about their kid going to school, I don't think this is going to make a huge difference to the trajectory of the country. That's what I think, especially if what looks like is going to happen happens. But we'll talk to that a little bit later on. But first of all, let's talk about Varadkar's career as such, because I wrote a piece yesterday, which I called an obituary for his career, in which, like, I'm just left feeling with a kind of feeling of emptiness and disappointment. I know there'll be a lot of listeners who'd be raging at Varadkar and say he's the worst leader we ever had. And there's a case to be made for that. But I just look at him as somebody who had all the talent and all the skill and all the conviction you could ever need to be a transformational leader for the good of the country, who effectively delivered nothing. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, I think that people always say, oh, this person and that person is the worst leader that we've ever had. And I've heard that about literally every single leader that we've had in my adult life, apart from maybe from Bertie. At the time of Bertie, nobody was saying that. They said it after. But they said it about Brian Cowan. They said it about Andy Kennedy. You know what I mean? They're, like, there's a lot of that knocking around. I think for me and my political stance on a number of things, Leo was hugely, at the very beginning, looked like something hugely optimistic, and, you know, someone that might have a kind of a common sense. He was very openly, you know, critical of waste, you know, like he seemed fiscally conservative. He seemed like he had kind of an idea, different ideas about things. He was pro-life. He was more conservative. And we never really got that leader. We got a completely transformed Leo Varadkar into, you know, a kind of an Irish Times sock puppet social justice warrior. And, you know, while, you know, like, I do think that, like, some of the stuff that's been said, you know, in the last week is true. Like, it's hard. Politics is a hard job. It's a lot of criticism. I think he did some things that were good. I don't think we have to kind of completely dismiss all the good stuff that he did. But I think that for me, you know, he's just one of these politicians who's been on this journey. And once people have been in these journeys and completely changed their position on things in the way he and Micheál Martin have, they kind of lose my respect a little bit. I'm all for people changing their mind, as I said before, but there was just something a bit cynical about it. And I think that that's a road he went down, and it was a bit disappointing.
He and we share a friend in common.
Yes.
Lucinda Creighton, who's one of his closest friends and somebody who I think you and I both know quite well and have a lot of time for. And I heard her on television last night, sort of crediting him. And she was asked like, what is his legacy? And I'll be honest, she kind of struggled to articulate one. And she came up with sort of marriage equality as one of the things that, you know, that was Leo's legacy. And I'm not sure she's right. I mean, this is why I say when I look at Leo, I just see disappointment, because the history books will show he'll take credit, some credit for that referendum passing, but I don't think that was his initiative. I don't think that he pushed that. I think there are a lot of left-wing progressive campaigners out there who'd be a little bit rightly annoyed to see Leo Varadkar being assigned credit for that. I don't even think he was even Taoiseach at the time. I think that was, unless I'm wrong, I think it was Enda Kenny, wasn't it? And even with that, I never got the sense with him that these things were matters of real conviction. I always felt he was, since he became sort of a minister and then later Taoiseach, he sort of just drifted along on the tide, going, and every now and again, the real Leo Varadkar would kind of break out for a minute. So he would. I think last November or something like that, he came out on the immigration thing and said, "Oh, we can't have people coming into the country, you know, without documents or whatever." I was like, okay, great to hear. Now, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah,
nothing. Like every now and again, he kind of would break out into say, like, I always got this sense that, and again, I know there'll be listeners thinking I'm being hugely too kind to him, but I always got this sense that he was kind of happy to let the country drift along, but kind of vaguely discontented with its drift at the same time, but never able to motivate himself to do anything about it. I never really got the feeling he was driving the car, so to speak. He always felt like the front seat passenger, offering commentary on, you know, which way the steering wheel was turning, and kind of, you know, saying, oh yeah, it's grand if we go this way, I suppose, as opposed to going a different way. That's the sense I got from him. And I think the voters responded to that by kind of, you know, sensing it and not really backing Fine Gael. Like at the last election, it ended up kind of becoming, I mean, they came in third behind Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, which I would argue is quite hard to do. But they did. So.
That was a real sly dick. Here's one thing I think is a legacy in it. And, you know, like, Ireland has changed. We're, you know, both 40 now. We can finally say that. And Ireland has changed a lot in our adult life or whatever. And one thing I think he did is, like, he's the first openly gay leader we've had. And mm-hmm. He made it not a big deal. And I don't think that that means anything to you or I. But I think that will probably mean a lot of things, a lot to some people. And I think it will mean a lot to people who are gay in the future. He went on radio one day. He was considered to be a conservative kind of politician. He came out as being gay and he went on to become the leader. And subsequently, TDs have come out and, you know, announced that they're gay. And it's a ripple now. And I think that that is a legacy for him.
Well, I would modify what you're saying there in one way, in that one thing I did appreciate about him was that it would have been very easy for him to make the first gay Taoiseach a real central part of his brand. And he never did that. You look at politicians like there's a guy in the US, Yes, he was commerce secretary under Barack Obama, who kind of made being like the first gay mayor of a small town in Indiana like his national brand. Varadkar never did that, to his credit. He never, and he did get a substantial amount of homophobic abuse. I've seen some of it. Maybe I'm looking at this through rose-tinted glasses now that he's gone, but I don't ever really recall him doing a sort of poor me on that front, which was, I think, the best way he could deal with that, to be fair and to his credit. So I take your point. But again, that also kind of sums up. I mean, if that's what we're saying about him, and not undoing what you've said, I mean, that's a very thin legacy to have.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the country now, you look at the situation of housing, health, education, immigration, crime, all the problems that we have. He's been 7 years leader of Fine Gael, five of them as Taoiseach. He's had control of the levers of the state in that time, and ultimately you have to lay responsibility for the state of the country at the feet of the leader of the country. You do, and voters have done it, I think. And ultimately, all political careers ended in failure, and I think this one really has ended in quite a miserable failure, to be honest, which is a pity because it could have been so different.
What about COVID? Not to get into the lockdown versus no lockdown debate or anything like that. Do you think that he felt like a good leader during the COVID?
Well, this is a good example of exactly what I'm talking about, because there was. Do you remember during? I don't want to get again. We're not going to get into the pros and cons of it. I think everyone has a fixed opinion on that at this stage. But there were two or three times during COVID where, like, you know, secret Leo kind of emerged from his cage, and he would say things like, "Oh, we need to get back to business. We can't lock down forever." Blah blah blah, and he would make these statements, and then nothing would happen. And it's like Tony Holohan would kind of like grunt in his direction, and Leo would pipe down again, and the ship of state continued with the chief medical officer at the tiller, with the Taoiseach as sort of a commentator in the back looking on. And you know, I don't think there's any doubt, if you go back and look at his public statements during COVID when he was off script, he was not necessarily comfortable with how long we locked down for or the general thrust of the and he did nothing about it. He just kind of went with the flow, because he never, for a politician who is supposedly a conviction politician, he never once had the conviction to stand up and say, I actually disagree with the consensus of the people running the country, and since I'm the Taoiseach, I'm going to overrule them. When did he do that? Never, I think. Not that I can think. I can't think of any examples.
But do any of them do that, Joe? Since kind of Charlie Haughey time, does anyone do that?
Well, Charlie Hawkey's a good example. He did do it. Bertie Ahern, I think, would have been somebody who did that several times. Mary Harney certainly was somebody who was very comfortable going against the grain of public opinion and taking loads of abuse. I think since the 2011 election, since Enda Kenny and Pat Rabbit, whoever was the leader of the Labour Party at the time, came into power, there's been a... Eamon Gilmore was. There's been a move away from that. But I think if you go back to that sort of the Bertie Ahern era, the John Bruton era into the 1990s, there were politicians who were Albert Reynolds, somebody who's completely different to Charles Haughey and hated Charles Haughey, as far as I know, was somebody else who would, you know, was very clearly the boss and called the shots. Whereas I don't feel, I think, you know, this current generation, there really isn't anyone like that. That's what I think. I think Varadkar could have been somebody like that. I also think that the aforementioned Lucinda Creighton, for example, his very close ally and friend, she, and I know people, some people out there will love her for it, some people will have disagreed with her, but she gave up her political career on a point of principle, in essence. Yeah. She walked away from, I mean, people forget that, you know, she was on the, I mean, had things panned out differently, she would probably be the obvious heir and successor and probably be the country's first woman Taoiseach today. I think there's a very strong chance of that, had she not given up her membership in Fine Gael on a point of principle. So there are people who chose a different path, I would suggest to you.
Well, that was our loss, big time. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard to judge the career overall in right now, and I also just feel like, and I try to not fall deep into conspiracy theories or whatever, but the whole announcement and the whole way it's played out has just felt so odd that I think we haven't had a chance to really absorb it properly and really think deeply about what his career has been, because, you know, we woke up one Wednesday morning and he was just gone. I mean, I take your point that you thought he was going to be gone before the end of the year, and you were right, but this wasn't the way anybody predicted it would happen.
No, but then Irish politicians do have this big thing, don't they, about going to St. Patrick's Day to see the president. I remember, was it Micheál Martin who kind of, do you remember when Micheál Martin was to give up the job as Taoiseach? Like, there was this whole spiel going on in the media for ages about, like, could he at least get a one St. Patrick's Day at the White House? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And eventually they managed to get him his St. Patrick's Day. And I think it was very shortly after that that the handover happened, because, you know, it's the high point apparently of any Irish political career is handing over the role of Shamrock in the Oval Office. And so it kind of feels like a natural point for them to go. I mean, you could quite easily imagine him kind of thinking to himself, well, I'll just get one more photo call in the Oval Office and then I'll go the next week.
Micheál got none because of COVID. That's right.
Did he get none or did he eventually get one? I can't remember.
I think he eventually got one. No, but there was a series of unfortunate events, wasn't there? That something was cancelled and there was COVID. Something. There was definitely, I'd have to look it up, but he kept getting shortchanged on the trip to the White House for sure.
I know. I just remember finding it utterly hilarious, especially all my colleagues in the media who kind of were engaged in this kind of mourning on Micheál's behalf that, God love him, he wouldn't get his moment in the Oval Office. I was like, that just summed up for me the kind of the state of the political class as a whole. Is kind of like, it's you know, really feeling sorry for him for not getting to hand over a bowl of Shamrock to the sitting president.
God forbid you didn't get to do your diddly eye piece.
Exactly. It's like being sorry for a four-year-old at a party who doesn't get to do his party piece. You'd feel more sorry for the four-year-old at the party. But anyway, I wonder if that was a factor in the timing. Look, I've had whispers from, but they're just that. They are whispers from sort of Fine Gaelers and some Fianna Fáilers about what might really be behind this. And none of them have ever actually offered a concrete theory. Somebody said to me this morning that Phil Hogan was in Dublin last week when they were all away in Washington, and they thought that was odd because Phil Hogan is rarely in Dublin. Phil Hogan is a big power player in Fine Gael despite being out of office. So there's also behind the scenes, there's lots of whispering and rumors going on about what really caused it, but I haven't heard a single plausible theory. And in fairness to the man, he did say yesterday, these are my reasons, they're the real reasons. And I think on that, until there's evidence the contrary, has to be taken as word.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as I said at the beginning of the show, I never got the impression this was a man who was enjoying the job. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, when you look back, things like a significant moment, he was giving out about immigration protests or something like that in the Dáil, and he basically appealed to the other around the chamber saying, I can't do this on my own, I need help from all of you. And that kind of felt like a politician who was not enjoying the job he was doing. Like, when you're appealing for help from the opposition to convince the public of something or other. And then there was the referendum pasting, and he came out in the aftermath of those referendums, which feels like months ago now, but was only really 10 or 12 days ago. He arrived in Dublin Castle, and in fairness to him, he took it on the chin. He said, we received an absolute pasting, but he looked shaken by it. He did look shaken, I thought, that day. And David Cameron, of course, resigned the premiership of Britain after the Brexit referendum, because he kind of just, as he wrote in his book afterwards, he felt that he was no longer in touch with the mood of the country. So my theory is he just had enough for Adker, I mean, and just packed it in.
It must be strange, though, to be 45 and be kind of like, right, what's, you know what I mean? Kind of interesting, but like, you know, you've peaked your political career anyway, so what next?
I suppose in fairness to him, there's always he has said in the past that he does want to go back and practice medicine. Although,
imagine you wait 4 weeks for a GP appointment and then you go in and play out. Like, a couple of things I'd like to discuss with you, actually. Yeah, I suppose if you get a medical degree, it's, you know, it's not something that you're going to just like never do, I suppose. But
problems for Fine Gael, actually, because I assume he's not going to run for re-election as a TD. He hasn't confirmed that, but that Dublin West seat actually looks, it's one of those ones you'd say with him on the ballot paper, it's a fairly safe hold, even if it is on the 7th or 8th count. But without him on the ballot paper, that's another seat that suddenly looks very shaky at an election for Fine Gael, I think.
I know, yeah. Now he went to the list of Fine Gael TDs who aren't running the next time, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll turn to the future. I'm sure that there'll be many. I'm sure many people will say at this point in the podcast, we've been far too nice to Leo Varadkar and that he's responsible for all the ills of the country. I think we have made that point, but you know we have to look to the future as well. And as at the moment that we're recording this podcast, which is earlier than usual on a Thursday because I have an event in DCU this evening, so we're recording it earlier than usual. But at the point we're recording it very much looks like Simon Harris is running away with the contest to become our next chieftain.
Ugh, I mean, where to begin with that? So I'm not a fan of Simon Harris for a variety of reasons. I think that he is quite cynical as a politician. I think that he is another journeyman. I think that he mismanaged a number of his portfolios in the past, and I think him becoming the leader of Fine Gael will be the best thing that's happened to Fianna Fáil in about 5 years. So he wouldn't be my choice, but if I was a strategist advising Fianna Fáil, I'd be encouraging it. Right, news. Now there is a small element of them having to vote for him, but I don't think that Fine Gael's fortunes can get much worse, but I don't think he's the answer. I think he's more of the same. I think he's more the kind of person who's going to chase that social justice crap down the street in the same way as Leo did. And I think that there are better options there. But no one else seems to be declaring and no one else seems to be talking and no one else seems to be canvassing. So I'm not sure what's going on.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate. And I am playing devil's advocate here, which is I think that Simon Harris, I can see why people would elect him. The first thing to say about Simon Harris is somebody who has dealt with him in the past, somebody who, you know, Ben is often engaging with him. I see a lot of footage of Simon Harris, is that he is, alongside Pascal Donoghue, who we'll talk about in a moment, by some distance, the most capable media performer that Fine Gael have. By some distance. The second thing I would say about him is that I said at the very beginning of this podcast about Leo Varadkar that I sense he didn't love the job and that he didn't, you know, he didn't have that kind of thirst for power that you need. Simon Harris has it to an almost psychotic degree, I think. I mean, this is somebody, I mean, I saw, I think it was Michael Lahan from RTE. If it wasn't, I apologize to who it was, but tweeting that there are some Fine Gaelers who think that the reason Harris has built up this massive amount of support inside 12 hours is because, unlike the others, he's been preparing for this day for years. You know, he's been planning this leadership campaign for you know, basically since the day Leo Varadkar got elected. This has always been the next step of his career. And I mean, he has shown, I mean, if there are other Fine Gaelers out there like Pascal Donoghue who are thinking about throwing their hat in the ring for this job, Simon Harris has just shown why you should never underestimate him, because he has blown them out of the water in the first 12 hours. There's another point about Simon Harris, which is there are a lot of people listening to this podcast who, like me, will have been appalled by almost everything he's done and said for the last 7 years and will regard him as the wokest of woke liberals in the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing with Simon Harris. If it suits him tomorrow to flip on a penny and become the most conservative immigration restrictionist law and order Fine Gaeler you ever saw in your life, then he will do it and he will sound plausible doing it. He has that ability. He has an ability. Like Micheál Martin has a little bit of this, but he's nothing compared to Simon Harris. He has the ability to adopt almost any position and make it sound that not only does he believe in it wholeheartedly, but he's the first and only person ever to have believed in it wholeheartedly, and it has always been his vision, and you should vote for him. He is, I have never seen him come off second best in an exchange with anybody. I regularly go on TV and radio and sort of debate or engage with Irish politicians. I used to do more, but I don't do as much anymore. He's one of the very few I'd ever have like been afraid of going into a debate. He is that good. And that is not to praise the man. That is just to say that if you're an opponent of Simon Harris, one thing you cannot do is underestimate him. That doesn't mean he's a good minister. Doesn't mean he'd be a good Taoiseach. Doesn't mean he has the skills to manage a department or lead a government. But in terms of the communication skills you need to do this job, I think he's streets ahead of anybody else in Fine Gael, with the possible exception of Pascal Donoghue, who doesn't seem to be running.
Look, it's hard to hear praise about people you don't like, because I just don't.
Well, I have to say, this is the thing. The other thing about Harris, I don't know if you've ever met him,
no.
But he is one of those people. I've never seen anybody else. I have seen people meet Simon Harris who thought they hated Simon Harris, who went to meet him and then came out of it saying, "Geez, he's a lovely fella."
That's true of loads of politicians.
It's true. I'd like to think there are people who said that of me too. But he has this. I mean, he's got. I mean, I at the risk of sounding like a fanboy, because I'm absolutely not, and I think he is by some distance the worst possible choice Fine Gael could make for their long term future. Mm-hmm. I absolutely don't think he should be underestimated by his opponents as a political operator. That said, I have no idea why they're not picking Pascal Donoghue. I have no idea why Pascal Donoghue isn't the automatic choice.
Yeah. So I like Pascal. we're speaking in politics now. I think Pascal is a kind of a statesman. I think he's done a good job as when he was in finance. You know, the budgets, he's very competent in his briefs. It's a safe pair of hands. Unlike Simon Harris, I feel like Pascal Donoghue draws back an old style Fine Gael voter. If he came out in the early days of his leadership strong on a couple of crime issues, I think he draws back an old Fine Gael vote that Fine Gael has been bleeding for a number of years. And I don't think Simon Harris does that. I don't think you get anything extra from Simon Harris that you didn't already get from Leo. But I do think that that's the case with Pascal. And if I was looking at it from a Fianna Fáil point of view, I'd be worried that they'll get that Pascal would end up being the leader, because I think Pascal is infinitely better, more palatable to public, more liked, safer. And he's a better... But you remember we were talking about it on the podcast a few months ago, where he, you know, took responsibility for something. I can't remember what it was, but he was being asked about something and he said, "Yeah, no, I take responsibility for the government's wins, so I take responsibility for our failures as well." He just seems like he comes across, his whole profile is kind of, you know, stable, steady, kind of fair-minded kind of person who'll keep the show on the road. And I don't think Simon Harris does that. I think Simon Harris is more of the same trendy, woke, social justice crap. And not a lot of... I mean, I take your point that he is a very good debater. But, like, other than that, you know, he's style over substance, I think.
There's another point. If I was choosing Pascal, I was thinking, like, in my former role as a moderately, people will vary on whether I was a good or a bad political strategist. A lot of people would say I was a terrible one. But if I was thinking like a political strategist, I would say, what are the contours of the next election? What is the ultimate decision the people are actually making? It's going to be a choice about essentially stability or radical change. And if I was to be thinking about that in those terms, obviously in that case, Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald represent the case for radical change. If I was thinking like a Fine Gaeler, who was hoping to reach people who are a little bit worried about Sinn Féin, who are unconvinced about Fine Gael, I would play the strongest card in my hand, which is Pascal Donoghue. He is the least radical politician you're going to find. He is somebody who, as Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure, can plausibly take credit for the one good thing this government has going for it, which is the sort of general state of the economy on paper, even if not in reality. And he also is somebody who is, he projects stability and steadiness. Nobody looks at Pascal Donoghue and says, that guy doesn't know what he's doing. They might think I don't agree with what he's doing, but they don't look at him and go, this guy's incompetent. And I think if the contours of that election become stability with Pascal Donoghue, who is boring and steady and, you know, nice and pleasant, versus, like, you know, Mary Lou McDonald saying we need completely radical change in the country, then there are a lot of small C conservative voters. I don't mean conservative in the sort of high Tory sense. I mean conservative in the I'm a bit wary of change sense, who I think would drift much more towards a Pascal type figure than they will towards a Simon Harris figure. The thing is, if I was writing a script to attack Simon Harris, it's very easy. Years ago, a clip of mine on I think it was Virgin Media went viral, when Simon Harris, the Minister for Health, and I said, look, what we've done in this country is we've taken a guy in his 30s who has never held a real job, who if he applied on the basis of his CV at the time he was appointed Minister for Health now, to run his local Tesco, would be told you don't have the correct experience. You've never done a managerial course. You don't have any experience in running a large organization. And we put him in charge of the Department of Health, which is an organization larger than NASA. And how did that work out? And now we're going to take this person who has absolutely, aside from a sort of failed a stint in the Department of Health, which ended with him being ejected.
Competence collapsed the last government.
Yeah, and we're going to make him Taoiseach. But Sarah, not we. We're not going to make him Taoiseach. Micheál Martin is ultimately the man who is going to make him Taoiseach. Having brought down the last government on the basis that Simon Harris was too incompetent to be a member of it, Micheál Martin is now going to vote to make him the head of it. I said this on social media yesterday, and one of my followers, who's literally the most staunch Fine Gaeler that has ever staunched for Fine Gael, very snittily replied to me that this is just politics and this happens all the time. And sure, didn't the PDs vote to make Charlie Hawley Taoiseach after walking out of Fianna Fáil because of Charlie Hawley? But the difference was there was an intervening election in which the public had placed their confidence in Charlie Hawley. They had said, we want Charlie Hawley to lead the largest party and probably be head of government. And the PDs had to decide whether they backed the public on that or didn't. In this case, the voters rendered their judgment on Simon Harris as Minister for Health in the election that followed his ousting and reduced Fine Gael to the third largest party. And now we're going to make him Taoiseach. I mean, I know technically, I asked a question yesterday about whether this was democratically legitimate, and people seem to mix up my question for whether this was legal. Of course it's legal. Of course they can do it under the Constitution. But, I mean, I think, yeah, I think this could ultimately end up being much more embarrassing for Fianna Fáil, or should be at least, than it is for Fine Gael.
Oh, for sure. But do you think that they should call an election then?
I mean, it's a delicate balance to walk, because if Micheál Martin came out tomorrow and said, no, I can't continue with this, if they're going to pick Simon Harris, there needs to be an election, he would need a pretext. But I think the problem is he has a pretext saying, we, in fairness now, we brought down the last government because we didn't think Simon Harris was a capable Minister for Health. He was no longer Minister for Health afterwards, but we can't justify making him Taoiseach. There needs to be an election. There should be an election. I think he would have that pretext. But I think ultimately, Micheál Martin, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, is somebody who's hardwired to be in power for as long as he possibly can. He loves the job. He doesn't want to give it up. And he said yesterday, it is just my belief that Dáil's and government should go full term because it promotes stability.
Yeah, but it was his belief on the 10th of September 2019 in a row that broke out between Simon Harris and Micheál Martin, where that Micheál Martin's belief then was that the Fine Gael TV, Simon Harris had been a poor and ineffective minister, according to the news.
And that Dáil should not go its full term. It's very coincidental that when he was in opposition, Micheál Martin was not of the view that government should go their full term.
Yeah. Um,
It's his view is should be modified to say it is my view that governments should go full term once I'm a member of them. Well, that's what he actually means.
He's been on a journey. It's another journey. But I mean, if there was, the other thing about this, John, is that if there was a couple of years left in this government term, it would be different. But like the reality of it is that at most is 11 months, right? And, you know, people can speculate all they like about whether there was going to be an election in September or whatever. But at the very latest, it's March. So by the time a new leader of Fine Gael will be in situ, it'll probably be another month. Would that be correct? Their Ordesh is in the middle of April.
I think the timeline is that they intend to have the new leader in place for the Ardèche, which is, I want to say, the 16th of April.
Yeah, I think it is. So it'll be kind of 10 months left. Like, I don't know. I mean, I think that you're right in the sense that, particularly if it's Simon Harris or whatever, you know, and rumblings, as we say, I've heard, is that there's a bit of, you know, bit of discontent among the Fianna Fáil ranks about the fact that they're now voting for somebody that, you know, they voted no confidence in before, and that ultimately they're just kind of look like they're being bent over a barrel by Fine Gael to kind of like keep this thing going, because Fine Gael or Leo has decided, you know, that he doesn't want to be leader and they have to go along with it, and they have to knock on doors in the local and European elections, doors that are extremely, extremely angry with the government in general. But this can go, could go really badly for Fianna Fáil over the next few weeks if it looks like Fianna Fáil are the reason why this whole thing has been allowed to continue.
Yeah.
But I think you're right that you walk a fine line, that like you don't either want to, you don't also don't want to look like you're having a bit of a tantrum and like collapsing the whole government as a result. But I just think that like you think about that referendum and that, like, you know, the, I've said before, you know, the 90% no boxes in places like Ballyfermot or whatever. What do you think those voters think of a switcheroo at the top table to a no election, no chance to have their say on it? I don't think they think much.
Yeah. And I mean, there are huge questions. As to, like when the Taoiseach was announcing his, he's still the Taoiseach, announced his resignation yesterday. If you go back and listen to what he said, one of the things he said, which was really interesting, was that on the timing, this was a good time because the negotiations on the next budget had not yet started. That was a reason he gave. The Northern Ireland is stable, and I don't know why that is always such a prerequisite for when we have elections down in the south, because I don't really see how that impacts, you know, when we should have an election. But apparently, it's often cited. Northern Ireland is stable. Brexit has been done and dusted. He said trade with the UK is in a good place. What is the reason for not having an election? What is the plausible reason for not having one? There really isn't one. I mean, the Taoiseach actually demolished the case yesterday for not having a general election when he cited all the reasons why it was a good time for him to resign. Because if his resignation causes instability, which he seemed to concede it did, and at the same time they're saying, well, a general election will cause instability, those two things, it can't be both a good time for the Taoiseach to resign and a bad time for there to be a general election.
Yeah,
I mean, you're contradicting yourselves there as a political class, not for the first time, certainly not for the last time, but they are. So this is all very self-serving in one respect. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, every time an opposition calls for a general election, you take that with a pinch of salt. That is what opposition TDs do. They're programmed to do it. Their job is to get out of opposition and into government. The only way to do that is a general election. They are programmed to call for a general election under almost any circumstances. But that doesn't mean they're wrong. Like, they're clearly, in my view, this country needs a general election. There has been, it was remarked on that until the referendums, we hadn't voted on anything as an electorate in 4 years. It is demonstrable that there is immense discontent in the country. Now, one can argue about what the nature of that discontent is or how it would be expressed, and I'm certainly not saying that like there's a massive movement out there to elect people that John McGurk and Sarah Ryan would agree with. I'm not saying that, but there is demonstrably great discontent in the country, and I'm not sure how the nation, as in the people of Ireland, are served by this government limping on for another 11 months in what effectively will be a sort of test run for a new Fine Gael leader to kind of prove that they look the part. That's what the next 11 months will be about. I mean, it's not going to be about anything else. So I don't know how that serves. It might serve the interests of Fine Gael. It might serve the interests of, you know, Fianna Fáil or the Greens a little bit, but I don't think it serves the country.
And if it's Simon Harris, the same bullshit agenda of the hate speech bill, and that'll all just continue. You know what I mean? So it's not like the public are going to get anything. You know, they're not going to get anything. They're not going to get their pound of flesh on anything. Nothing's going to change. It's just going to be the same old with a different face.
I think if it's Simon Harris, my predictions for the year are going fairly well. I'm going to suggest something that will shock people. And if I'm wrong, play this clip back at me, Sarah, in a couple of weeks and mock me for it. But I think if it's Simon Harris, I think he will ditch the hate speech bill.
No.
I think he will.
Why?
Because it's in his nature. This is the kind of guy he is. He will look and he will say, what do I need to do to signal to voters that I'm different from what came before? Now, he's not going to do anything that would be really radical, like, you know, suddenly start overhauling sort of the courts or impeaching judges or engaging in, you know, mandatory minimum sentencing or anything radical on housing.
Anything good. Yeah.
But he can simply say that the hate speech bill is no longer a priority for the government and, you know, move on. And there will be much rejoicing and he will wrong-foot his opponents, which he also loves doing. Because there'll be lots of people out there who will see him as one thing and say, oh, you know, he's going to ram this thing through, and then he won't. I think you have to think a little bit like Simon Harris, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he'll come out and he'll say this is one of his main priorities as soon as he takes office. But I would be surprised. I'll put it that way.
So do you think Pascal would do something different?
So no, I'm.
No, I mean, no, do you think Pascal would do the same as a matter of interest? Do you think any new leader would just use that as the opportunity to show themselves as different? Or do you think specifically Simon Harris would can it because he just doesn't have any real...
I think Pascal would do the same thing too. I think there is a recognition at the top of Fine Gael that while they are publicly pledged to this piece of legislation, it's not light. And it's generating a lot of the sort of the populist swell of discontent out there is coming from the hate speech bill is something people can point to as an example of the government's sort of anti the public stance, put it that way. And I think canning it is an easy way to take the sting out of a lot of that anger straight off the bat. I think it's the politically sensible thing to do. Because, of course, thinking like a cynic, that doesn't mean that it can't be brought back again sometime in the future, in a couple of years down the road or whatever. But for now, it's a really easy thing that you can do that costs you absolutely nothing. And I think people who are convinced opponents of this legislation really overestimate the degree to which there is massive conviction in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael behind it. There's massive conviction from the Social Democrats. I'm having a debate this evening with their Dublin European candidate in DCU on that very topic. There's massive conviction in the NGOs, but you and I both know Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers. There's none of them who would turn to you in the privacy of a conversation that isn't being recorded and say, yeah, I think this is a great idea and you're totally wrong about it. The most you get is a sort of shrug of the shoulders.
Yeah.
So that is, and the other thing is, I'm not convinced that Helen McEntee is long for the Department of Justice.
Well, this will be another interesting thing because there presumably will be a reshuffle now as well. So that might yield some interesting changes. I just think when I picture Simon Harris as the Taoiseach, in my core political view, I think, and this is just an anecdotal feeling, but I think it's correct. I think people like Pascal more than they like Simon Harris.
I think you're correct.
And I think it's a mistake for Fine Gael. And I don't know what, like, I mean, obviously there's a big groundswell of support behind him. I don't know why they think that that's a good idea. Because if they're looking to retain their seats in the next election, I don't think it's the best plan.
Well, I think there are questions for Pascal Donoghue here too. I mean, there are two possibilities. Either he wants the job, in which case his efforts to secure it have been pitiful. I mean, he's at the time that we're chatting, Simon Harris is now up to 24 members of the parliamentary party backing him. Once he gets to 40, by the way, that's it, game over, mathematically secure. Pascal Donoghue has nobody publicly backing him, which tells me that if he wants the job, then he has done an immensely poor job of generating momentum behind his candidacy. I don't think Pascal is that incompetent, which leads me to believe maybe he just doesn't want the job. There's been some speculation that he wants a job in Europe. But I think that people shouldn't underestimate the degree to which that's a, you know, if you get a, if you're the European Commissioner, I mean, you uproot your entire family, move them all to Brussels for 5 years. There's only a few people in the country for whom that's a sort of an attractive proposition. Whereas if you're a Taoiseach, you get to, not only do you have more direct power in your own country, but you know, it's just a better job. So I'm not sure that's it. So maybe he just is. Maybe Pascal is one of those people who's never wanted to be leader. Maybe he just wants to be a minister for finance. But if he wants the job, he's done an objectively poor job at making a play for it. So
maybe there's some strategy at hand that we don't see.
Yeah, maybe maybe by the time you're listening to this, and if you are, and we look like idiots, maybe Pascal Donoghue will have appeared on the news this evening, surrounded by 7 members of the cabinet and 14 TDs behind him.
Burst out of the trap.
Yeah.
20 TDs holding him up on the plinth.
Hmm.
Yeah, maybe.
But at the time we're recording this, he you know, unless there's something like that afoot, it's all been rather unimpressive from the Pascal Donoghue camp.
And what about the other candidates? Just because, you know, just in the interest of fairness, there is like long shots like Jennifer Carroll McNeil, and then Heather Humphreys, and Coveney's ruled himself out. Am I right?
Yeah, I think Coveney is in one level. It's sort of his official reason is that he always said he was running for the job once, and if he didn't get it, he wasn't going to make a second go. But I don't buy that. I have to say
that is a dumb reason.
Yeah, I have to say. I mean, I think it, unfortunately for Simon Coveney, I don't think you can separate his candidacy from the recent sort of, I don't want to use the word scandal, but controversy involving his brother's departure from RTE. I think that's just sometimes in life things come at a bad time. I think that might have happened to Simon Coveney in this case. It's not his fault. He's not his brother's keeper. That's absolutely the case, but I still think it would be inevitable that he'd spend months and months answering questions about whether Rory Coveney should testify to an Oireachtas committee, which isn't great for Finnegan. I think Heather Humphreys, she's an interesting candidate. I just don't think she'd win. I just don't think, looking at the strength Simon Harris has already amassed, Heather Humphreys is a really solid minister who's having a really solid political career. I think here's what I think will happen, regardless of whether it's Harris or Donoghue in the end. I would expect Heather Humphreys to be the new Minister for Justice.
Really?
I would expect Helen McEntee. Well, she's already had experience in that department. Don't forget when McEntee was on maternity leave, and
yeah, did
credibly and competently. And I would expect McEntee, if it's Simon Harris, a vacancy will obviously be created in higher education, which is really the ministry for handing out grants to universities and students. I think that looks like a nice landing place for Helen McEntee, doesn't it? You know, she can't really do any harm in higher education. She can go around the country handing out grants and talking about the importance of opportunities for young people. And then you create a vacancy in the Department of Social Welfare, which would be an ideal landing spot for somebody like a Jennifer Carroll McNeil. But so I don't think Heather Humphreys has an incentive to run unless she's certain she can win. And at this point, I don't think that's likely. But somebody like Carroll McNeil, who's outside the cabinet, she has an incentive to run. Because if it looks like it's going to be a coronation for Simon Harris, there's clearly an anti-Simon Harris vote in Fine Gael that will go to somebody else. And if you're somebody like Jennifer Carroll McNeil, who says we should skip a generation and go for somebody outside the cabinet, you're not going to win. But when the dust settles, Harris is going to be forced, basically, to appoint you to a very big job in the government to show that he's
magnanimous. Yeah.
And at the same time, you're positioning yourself as the heir apparent should anything unfortunate happen to Simon Harris, like an election defeat, for example. But I don't know if any of that will happen.
What also happens if, you know, you're Harris and you get into the top spot or whatever, and there's, you know, an inevitability, which I think it is the case, that there's, you know, that regardless of whether you're Pascal or Simon Harris, there's an inevitability to a pacing that Fine Gael are going to get in the local and European elections. And if you get a really, really, really bad day, are people looking for you to resign, even though you've only been there for a few months?
Well, I don't think that's the risk, is it? It's not the risk that the Fine Gaelers in the parliamentary party will turn on, because, I mean, those of us who follow politics for a living know that Fine Gael are almost guaranteed a bad result in the local elections for the simple reason that at the last local election, Sinn Féin had a shocking day. They only got, I think, 12 or 13% of the vote. Now, they're guaranteed, unless something amazing happens between now and then, to basically double that. And a lot of those increases of seats will come at the expense of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So Fine Gael are almost guaranteed to have a shockingly bad day in the local elections, and Sinn Féin are almost guaranteed to have a really good day. And if you're listening to this podcast, you'll know that ahead of time, because when those results happen, people will present them as like a massive shifting wind of change. But you have to look at the starting points for each party. I mean, there's going to be a massive shift in seats in favour of Sinn Féin if the polls stay where they are, even though their support hasn't really changed from the last general election. So I think inside the Fine Gael parliamentary party, a new leader getting a pacing at the local and European elections will be understood. The problem will be if the stench of loser is immediately attached to that person with the public. Do you know what I mean? If you're Simon Harris and your first electoral outing is a pasting, the voters and politicians move in herds. And voters might look at that and kind of go, oh, well, he's clearly not that popular. And that will colour their views of him. So I think that's the bigger risk. I don't think Fine Gael will kick him out, but I think there's a real risk that the public might look at those results and kind of go, well, clearly my neighbours don't think much of him, so why should I? Maybe I'm wrong if I like him.
Yeah, I'm not sure Sinn Féin are going to have that good of a day. I don't know. I just feel like something has shifted there as well. But I mean, you know, if you're a new leader and you're coming out of the town centre in June or whatever it is, and you know you've taken a serious pasting, I think you're right that it sticks. You know, like, I don't think it's guaranteed that all nine genders, Doherty is getting a seat for Fine Gael in Europe. So, like, you know, like no European seat in Dublin, and you know, loss of a good few councillors. It's a knock to your knees that you now have to get back up from, and it's not long until a general election for that recovery to happen. So,
they're almost guaranteed to lose a seat in Ireland South because Deirdre Clune is retiring.
If you had the local and European elections, for example, and then you had 2 years after them to kind of recover, find your feet, and get back up again, one thing. But if you have local and European elections in June, and we know that the maximum, you know, that you can go after that before you have a general election is kind of 7 or 8 months, that's tricky.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing is, as I said a few minutes ago on the podcast, if there's opposition politicians are mandated by law, apparently, to call for general elections at every opportunity. So in the immediate aftermath of the local and European elections, I'm telling you now, so you're not surprised if you're listening to this, every opposition politician will be calling for general election. The voters have rendered their verdict on this government, they will say.
Ivana Bacic was saying yesterday that the people, not Fine Gael, should decide who leads the country. It's time for a general election now. Does she have another job lined up?
Yes.
If I were her, I'd be keeping my mouth shut. Like,
she does, of course. I think she remains on leave from her position as Reid Professor of Criminal Law in Trinity, so she does have another job lined up. Is the short answer.
Well, that's good. That's good.
And I have no doubt that a return to the Shannon in short order would follow, courtesy of the electors of Trinity College Dublin, who are the only bunch of electors in the country ever to have reliably elected Ivana Bacic to anything.
If Ivana really wants a general election, I'll be ringing up Trinity and asking them to the IT department to make sure my fob is still active, because I'll probably be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. It's all fun and games. As I say, I'm not sure it's quite earthquake. I think it's earthquake in political terms inside Fine Gael, and maybe causing some tremors for Fianna Fáil and the Greens. But ultimately, I thought when this day came, I'd be more excited about it than I was. Like, I thought it might, and I actually think in some ways it's bad for the country too, because the voters will never now get a verdict, get an opportunity to render a verdict on the Varadkar premiership, one way or the other.
I'm not sure. I think the contempt is much more thinly spread over many than that. I never really got the impression it was a huge, you know, like, I think it's a plague on all the houses. It's not just Leo.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But at the end of the day, if that's the political mood in the country, I think he bears the blame for it. He's the leader of the country. And I mean, I wrote in that piece yesterday, I really do wonder when he sits down in 20 years, and God willing, he's still alive and healthy and, you know, happy in 20 years' time. But when he looks back, you know, two decades hence on his political career, I think he'll have a lot of regrets. I really do think he will have a lot of regrets because, you know, when you look back at him, he entered politics in 2004, winning a still record 38% of the vote in a local election. And Fine Gael eyes lit up and they said, this guy is a transformational, generational vote winner. He's going to be to us what Bertie Ahern has been to Fianna Fáil. He's young. He's of migrant heritage. He represents the country. But he's also very clearly a Fine Gaeler with a distinct Fine Gael view of the world. He's going to be our Lionel Messi.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I've just looked down at my phone and Pascal has ruled himself out.
Well, there you go. So Taoiseach Simon Harris it is.
God, that's depressing. Yeah. I mean, at least I'm not a Fianna Fáil TV who has to vote for it, because that would just be humiliating. But I don't know. Time will tell, but I think it's a huge mistake for Fine Gael. That's my view.
Yeah. Anyway, to finish my thoughts, when I look at Leo Varadkar's career, I mean, it began with such promise, and he was very clearly somebody who had very strong views on reforming government, cutting. I mean, he people forget that young Leo Varadkar used to talk about cutting all the funding for NGOs and quangos and all this sort of stuff. And
deadly stuff.
And then it just kind of drifted into drift. Where he kind of became, it was like he was a boat on the ocean and he lost his sails and he just went where the tide took him. And always felt like a distinctly unenthusiastic leader of where he was leading the country. So I really do think that, you know, 20 years from now, when he's, you know, 65 years old and, I don't know, lecturing in some university or whatever he's doing, he will... Like, I often think one of the most tragic figures in Irish politics was Gareth Fitzgerald. Because I don't know, when you were in college and I was in college, sort of the early 2000s, late 1990s, Gareth Fitzgerald was everywhere. He'd be in the university every week talking to some college society or other about all the things he did. And I remember Leo Varadkar talking across the Dáil chamber to, I think it was some Fianna Fáiler. It might have been Bertie Ahern, might have been Brian Callan. Can't remember who it was. And he said, that's what you are. You're not a leader. You're a Gareth Fitzgerald. And he used Gareth Fitzgerald as a pejorative and said, that's how you'll end up. You'll be somebody kind of like wandering around justifying what you did. I think that's Leo's destiny for himself. I think he's going to be another Gareth Fitzgerald. The guy who spends the rest of his career in retirement wandering around trying to tell students about the glory days when he was Taoiseach, while the rest of us don't really see much merit in it at all. Nobody lists Gareth Fitzgerald amongst one of our great Taoiseach, you know. And I don't think anyone's going to do that for Varadkar either. That's what I think.
Well, that's pretty depressing. But it's hard to disagree with that, to be honest, John.
Yeah, well, anyway, our apologies to listeners who like hearing us talk about other things and not just the ins and outs of politics, but we are here to discuss what happened during the week, and there really wasn't a bigger story this week. In fact, I have to say, on yesterday, Wednesday, was looking like quite a slow news day until all of this happened.
Sometimes the government gets a complete pasting in two referenda, and we have an emergency episode about that. And sometimes the Taoiseach of the country resigns, and we just have a whole episode about that. Give a little, take a little, you know.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, I think we're we've just about hit an hour, so we won't bore the people any longer with our thoughts. We will see you all next week for another edition of The Week That Really Was. Until then, from Sarah and from me, have a great weekend.